Welcome to Relevant Parties by Carhartt Work in Progress. I'm Chelle Ravens, and in this series, I'm going behind the scenes at some of the world's best independent record labels to meet the visionaries and the obsessives who've made musical history. In each episode, we sit down with one of these label founders to find out what makes them tick. We hear the tall tales and big ideas behind some of the most influential records and scenes of the past 30 years, and maybe try to work out just what possessed them to take on one of the most challenging jobs in the music industry. My guest this week is Chris Manack, better known to the world as Peanut Butter Wolf. It's an alias he's had since his teenage years growing up in San Jose, California. And one thing about Peanut Butter Wolf, or Wolf to his friends, is that he has always wanted to run a record label. Always. This guy wrote an essay in high school dreaming about running his own record label. And now, nearly 25 years after launching Stone's Throw Records, he is as dedicated to that dream as ever. I like to think of Peanut Butter Wolf as a pure record label guy. He's kind of classic. He's kind of old school. He has a huge personal collection of vinyl records, famously. He keeps everything. He archives it. He really cares about vinyl as a format. And as a label boss, he's really only interested in releasing music that he likes. That is basically it. But among the many kinds of music you can find on Stone Throw, there are some standouts that rank among the greatest hip-hop records ever made, centering around the genius that is Madlib, who's been in the Stone Throw universe since pretty much the beginning, and his work with the late great Jay Dilla and the masked man MF Doom. But although Stone Throw is indelibly associated with this particular strand of hip-hop, that kind of jazzy, sampledelic sound that came through in all of Madlib's music, and the legacy of Dilla and his crate-digging disciples, Stone's Throw is actually a very broad church. You've got Maya Hawthorne doing vintage soul. You've got all kinds of eccentric funk and pop hybrids from the Stepkids and Dame Funk. You've got Gary Wilson doing lo-fi new wave, this kind of relic from the 70s. And then a massive hit single in the middle of that from a man called Allo Black. So Peanut Butter Wolf dialed in from his base in LA to talk about the heady days when Madlib, Dilla and Doom were shacked up at Stone's Throw HQ, just making amazing records day in, day out. We talked about Wolf's early years in San Jose and the tragic loss of Charisma, the young rapper who was his closest childhood friend and partner in rhyme. We talked about Allo Black and the extraordinary experience of having a hit single that you're maybe not that in love with. And we also talked a lot about the documentary that was made about Stone's Throw several years ago, Our Vinyl Weighs a Ton, which was really interesting. If you saw that doc, you'll want to listen to what Wolf has to say about it all. So here we go. This is Relevant Parties meets Stone's Throw Records. Hi.
How are you?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
I'm good.
I wanted to start off with a broader question. So one of the ideas behind this podcast series is to think about the role that independent record labels have had in shaping music and culture and bringing new, maybe experimental ideas into the mainstream, being a kind of conduit for adventurous ideas, I guess. But on the flip side, I think what it means to be independent or underground has changed quite a lot, definitely changed in the time that you've had a label. The role of the indie record label has changed quite a lot. And I found this article about Stone's Throw on the website Forbes. And Forbes is, for want of a better word, I guess it's a website about business and money.
Yeah.
And the title of this interview was When Putting Art Before Economics Actually Works, mm-hmm. which I found quite funny. The writer is suggesting that normally what works, quote unquote, is to put the economics first. And I know that you have a degree in marketing, right? A long time ago, that was your degree.
Yeah, back in the olden days, yeah.
Yeah, so you'll have thought about a lot of this in school and in life, I guess. So I wondered if you think that being an independent record label means putting art before economics.
Well, the art part for me is like, why I enjoy doing it. And then I also do have to consider the well-being of the artists, like everyone that I work with, I want to be able to help them make money and help them make a career out of it. So I don't really want to jump on board with someone if I don't think I'm going to be able to help them make money or help them make a career out of it. So it that part gets tricky. And then I also, you know, I have a staff that I have to make sure I'm paying. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that, I mean, everything that I sign is something that I like, you know, that's first and foremost. But then I also do have to believe that I'm going to be able to find other people who like it as well. And right now, you know, it's a lot of streaming and stuff like that. I mean, more so than ever these 2 months with the pandemic we're dealing with. But yeah, it's the balance thing. And I'm a Libra, so Libras say that they're very balanced. And then people who are not Libras say, no, they're seeking balance. But, you know, whichever you believe, balance is like a part of that.
Are you a believer in astrology?
A lot of times it seems kind of spot on, but I don't like read it all. I can't say, oh, you're a Leo, so I know this and this and this about you.
Say that I hate it, but I'm a Capricorn, and then people who know about astrology are like, oh, well, oh, of course you don't believe in astrology because you're a Capricorn.
Oh, so exactly.
Maybe.
I don't even know what Capricorn. Yeah, I don't know what makes.
Like boring, goat, hardworking, something. I don't relate. Okay. I don't relate at all. Okay, so we'll get on to some of the kind of history, the iconic records, the weirder records. But I wanted to actually, following on from the art and economics, I wanted to get the big hit out of the way. Okay. 'Cause Stones Throw had a pop hit, a hit single, I Need a Dollar by Alan Black.
Yeah.
Which went platinum in a few countries.
It was here even.
Oh yeah, my dad would know this song, you know. This is a big hit. And I was wondering how you cope with having a hit like that, because in a way it's so much bigger and so much more unwieldy than an independent record label is set up to manage. How do you cope with having an unexpected platinum hit single?
Well, I mean, you mentioned your dad, and yeah, my mom's 75, and that's probably the only artist that she knows on Stones Throw. And like, whenever I talk to her, she goes, oh, I saw Alla Black on Dancing with the Stars. And, you know, like, she's like major, like, that's the only, I mean, that literally is the only artist that she knows. And, I mean, when I signed Alla, I signed him for his voice. I thought he had a great voice. And I also, just hanging out with him, he just had a great attitude, and I'm like, this guy is going to go far. So we did one album with him that was kind of more like future jazz sounding, like kind of Giles Peterson style or whatever. You know, I guess Giles Peterson's a genre in a way.
Oh, yeah. And, in the UK, I think he counts as a genre.
Yeah, and I loved his first album, and then after that, he just kept turning stuff in that I wasn't really into, and he had, I don't know, it didn't really have any edge to it or whatever. And I just kept like being like, oh yeah, that's cool, but I think you should keep recording. And I was like, basically like that label nightmare guy that I never wanted to be. You know, when I signed with a label, with a major label I was going to say a kid, but I guess I was early 20s. I wanted that label to just sign me because they liked what I did. And so with Stones Throw, I always do that. I only sign people where I'm not trying to change them. Like where I hear something and I already like it the way it is. That it never really ends up working that way. And with Alla, like I liked his early stuff and then he started changing, and everybody changes, you know, everyone goes different directions, and that's life. And I almost didn't put that album out. I wasn't really into the direction he was going. And, you know, right, like, to rewind back, before putting out Alla's album, I put out some stuff with an artist, Mayor Hawthorne, who is a rapper who I heard some stuff that where he was singing, and I wanted to put that out. And then Alla heard that, and I was like, oh, he's doing that retro thing, I can do that. But I didn't like the way it was going so much. And I was this close to not putting out I Need a Dollar. And I know Alla was frustrated, and I totally understand that. And, you know, it basically, yeah, it did bigger than any of us thought it would. A lot of it was because of his work ethic and, you know, doing, understanding when opportunities come to jump at them. And, you know, he was doing all these shows in Europe, and he just kept kind of climbing up the ladder of doing all the festivals and stuff. And he wasn't getting any gigs in the U.S. Like, that, his gigs in the U.S. were probably like a fraction of what he was making in Europe. So he just kept going where the money was. Like, ironically, I need a dollar. And he blew up, yeah, big out there. And then the Avicii thing hit, and then that was even bigger. And then you know, we worked out a deal with a major label to kind of take over the project and stuff. But it was already like, without the major label help, we had already like achieved a lot, pretty much.
Are you quite a hands-on A&R type of label boss? Do you get involved in like sequencing and artwork and kind of ideas for concepts for albums and things?
I enjoy that. I mean, being a DJ, you know, like a DJ is basically just somebody who takes other people's music and like sequences it and, you know, tries to tell a story with it or whatever without over romanticizing it. But yeah, I mean, that's what I really enjoy doing. Like, you know, to this day with the artists, I still, and some artists, they have like a clear vision the whole way. And then some guys are like, hey, I want you to be involved with that part of it. John Carroll Kirby, for example, he's like, hey, you want to sequence the album? I'm like, oh, I'd be honored. Thank you. You know, so it's not like I don't just plug it into every artist. Like everyone's, you know, I have my own relationships with all the guys.
Yeah. And I guess these days it's so easy to just release a record if that's all you want to do, that in a sense, part of what a label can really do for you is be that kind of sounding board and trust somebody to guide you through the process a little bit.
It is kind of that mutual respect thing, yeah.
So let's rewind, take it back. You grew up in San Jose. So that's a city that's just south of San Francisco. I guess for some people that's Silicon Valley.
Correct.
What was San Jose like for you as a kid growing up there?
So my dad was in the Army, and then he was also like a software engineer, aerospace engineer, and he moved to the Bay Area eventually because of the Silicon Valley thing. So I moved there when I was 6, and then I got into hip hop, I got into like funk and soul, I guess, when I was 9. And disco and rap. Rapper's Delight had just come out. This was 1979. Yeah, music was like my everything, even as a child, I guess.
Were you listening to music that people in San Jose were listening to? Was that what you heard around on the streets and stuff?
That's a good question. So there was a roller rink called Cal Skate where you would hear a lot of that music. You would hear...
Cool.
You'd hear a lot of the funk Cameo and the Gap Band and that sort of thing. And... yeah, as a preteen or whatever, like 10, 12-year-old, you either liked soul or you liked rock, and you weren't really allowed to like both. So I was like really into, I mean, through disco, I learned about soul and funk, and there was a radio station called KSOL, K-Soul. That was like, yeah, how I found all my music and stuff in the early days. And then, you know, when Rapper's Delight came out, that was the first hip-hop like record. But anything like there was a song Double Dutch Bus, to me that was hip hop as a kid. But looking back, people are like, no, that's not. It's like that was an old dude trying to do what the kids are doing or whatever. I guess I got deeper and deeper into hip hop, and San Jose wasn't so much of a hip hop city at that point. Like in the mid to late, I guess in the late 80s. Like I got my first turntables when I was 14. I had like a mixer and was learning how to DJ. Because of this song called Rocket by Herbie Hancock that had scratching. And all I wanted to do was scratch. I didn't care about like mixing, or I didn't even care about having two turntables. As long as I had like some, like I could play a tape and then scratch along with it with my turntable, as long as I had a mixer with a crossfader. So that was really big for me. I have a tape of me like when I just took the song Numbers by Kraftwerk and just played it over and over and over again and just kept scratching like... And I just, you know, recorded the whole thing. And so
that's nice to think of how influential that particular song is as well, given that Florian Schneider has just left this earth. And I was reading about Numbers recently and the kind of impact it had just on Detroit as a city, and like crazy how so many songs were taken from the Man Machine and turned into like electro tracks or techno tracks.
Exactly. And I was talking to Moody Man, and he was telling me, like, when Kraftwerk went to Detroit, I don't remember if he said he went to the show, but he was telling me the story that when Kraftwerk did their show in Detroit, they looked out into the audience, and the whole audience was black, and they were like, oh, I think we're at the wrong spot. Like, because they're just used to having a white audience in Germany, yeah. You know? And it was pretty incredible to see, you know, other people, like, just appreciating it. I did a festival last year in Croatia, and one of the main reasons why I agreed to do it was because I heard that Kraftwerk were doing it, and I'd never seen them live. So I get to Croatia, and, you know, the guy's showing me around, and I'm all, so when is Kraftwerk on? And they said, oh, it's a two-day festival, and they played yesterday, you played today. I'm like, oh, shit.
That is a long way to go to fail to see Kraftwerk. I'm surprised you've never seen them, though. I've never seen them.
I know, it's pretty crazy.
So I know that you wrote an essay. This is part of the Stone's Throw law, is that you wrote an essay in high school about wanting to run a record label. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
But why, see, as a kid, you could want to do all kinds of things in the music industry. There are loads of jobs out there that would be kind of fun. But why was record label owner something that you already kind of knew about and wanted?
Yeah, so at that point, this was like 85, 86, and all my favorite hip hop records were coming out on independent labels. So I just saw that as like, yeah, I mean, that just even cooler than being in an, you know, being on stage or anything would be like to actually put out these records of this cool music that I loved.
What kind of labels were you inspired by?
There was a label, Beauty and the Beat. I remember I was trying to get signed to them at one point, and that was like kind of one of the lesser known ones, but like Sleeping Bag, I guess it was putting out a lot of cool hip hop that I liked, and Jive was doing some good stuff. Cold Chillin'. Yeah, there was a lot. There was a label, Sunny View, but there, you know, these certain labels, like when I went into the record store, and with hip hop, most of the hip hop I was buying, you couldn't hear it on the radio. There, you know, there obviously was no internet. So the way you would find out about it was either through a mixtape from another DJ or physically going into the record store and just looking at stuff and taking a chance. You know, it's easy to take a chance when there's artwork that has what the group looks like, and the back of the record says what instruments are used and that kind of thing. But a lot of these hip hop records didn't have any artwork. It just said the name of the group and the name of the song. And I guess by the name of the group, you could go, oh, that sounds like a rapper, I'm going to buy that. But the label was really important. So the Sunny View records would always have that same look to them. And you would just kind of buy, you know, based on the label that it was on.
And you already buying a lot of records by this point, right?
Yeah. So I mean, during this quarantine, what I've been doing is I've been just writing down all the records that I bought as a kid, and just by year. Like, so.
Oh, wow.
And it ends up being like 100 records a year, which is like 2 records a week, I guess, you know. And I would just, that would just be like what I would save. Like, I would just wouldn't eat at school. My mom would give me money for lunch, and I would just save it and just use it on the records.
And you've kept everything from that time?
Yeah, I mean, I never really get rid of it, but I do rebuy records that I had back then. So it's hard to say, like, is it the one that I bought in 1979 or did I buy it in 1982?
So around this time, you decided to try out your own record company, PMR Records.
Oh yeah. So that was in 1990.
What's the PMR for?
Poetical Movement Records.
this didn't go so well, right?
No, that was in San Jose. And at the time I was a DJ at KSJS, which is San Jose State's radio station. And they had a hip hop show called Project Sound. Basically the program director of that, and then her name was Kim Collette, and this guy, George Hudley, they both were DJs, and they wanted to put this record out, and they saved some money. And then they asked me if I wanted to go in on it with them. So we each put $500 in, and for $1,500, we pressed 500 copies of this record. But we didn't know anything about mastering or distribution. I mean, so then we had all these records, and what are we going to do with them, you know? And they sounded horrible because it wasn't mastered, so it sounded really lo-fi. But I liked how it sounded. I always liked raw. I never liked things too polished. So it was fine by me, and now it's like one of those Discogs records. It's like $500.
But who was the artist on the record?
The artist is called Lyrical Prophecy, and it was two rappers and two producers, myself and this other guy, Well, he went by DJ Ralim, and now he goes by King Assassin. He does more gangster rap now.
And around that time, well, maybe even earlier, you got the Peanut Butter Wolf name. I think a lot of people probably know the story, but why are you called Peanut Butter Wolf?
Yeah, it's almost like losing a bet, but it was basically my girlfriend at the time, her little brother. We were playing this game Candyland with him. I don't know if that game's in the UK too, probably not. But anyways, yeah, we were trying to scare the kid. We were turning the light off, and then he said, "Oh, turn on the light. The peanut butter wolf is going to get me." But it just sounded so weird, you know. And I was 19 at the time, and then I was in a punk band with my brother. My brother was like 7, and he was the lead singer, or 8. And so we would always sing songs about this peanut butter wolf character. And then I was making beats for this guy Charisma, and he heard the punk rock stuff, and he's like, "Oh, that's a cool name. You should change your DJ name to Peanut Butter Wolf." So
you've met Charisma at this point, who becomes a partner in crime of sorts. Tell me what did you have in common with Charisma? Why did you two form a bond as kids?
So I put out that record first in 1990, and then at that point, like, pretty much there was no hip hop groups in San Jose that had an actual record out. So after that came out, pretty much every rapper in the neighborhood, or not even the neighborhood, in the city, like, knew about us and was like, "Oh, we want to, you know, meet these guys and work with them and stuff." So it was really easy for me to find talent after putting out that first record. And a guy from my high school, he brought Charisma over my house, and Charisma was 16. He was in high school, and I was like 19 or 20. At that point, I had this idea. I wanted to do a compilation album with all different rappers where I was making the beats for all of them. I wanted Charisma to be part of that, but it was hard. I was really like, there were so many people, like, I was trying to keep a schedule. Okay, this person comes over Monday, this person Wednesday, whatever. And Charisma was like, "Man, come on." Like, he was really, really frustrated, and he's like, "Well, I'm the best out of all the rappers you're working with, so eventually you're going to drop them all and just work with me only." And it was kind of like a mind game, I think, or I don't even know if he meant it that way, but, you know, it ended up being the case. And, like, I noticed with a lot of the other rappers I was working with, our bond was just kind of music, and that was it. But with Charisma, like, I don't know, we just related to each other a lot more. It just felt like more of a friendship, not only, like, making music together.
And you ended up hanging out a lot, right? You weren't just like making music together, but you were hanging out as friends most of the time. I kind of got that impression from the documentary, maybe.
Yeah. He became my best friend for sure.
So musically though, at that time, I mean, West Coast rap is like blowing up, I guess, but maybe musically that wasn't what you were more interested in. Like, how did you see yourselves in terms of what was going on in rap at the time?
Well, I think, the more of the gangster rap and the player rap was big, especially in the Bay Area, but yeah, the West Coast in general. But then there were some groups that were more traditional East Coast, kind of like, I guess, the Far Side had already come out at that point, you know, and they were doing well. Digital Underground was doing real well. And actually, Digital Underground, they got a hold of our demo tape and they really liked it, and they showed it to a record label, and that's what got us signed. And so the first tour that Charisma and I went on, maybe the only tour, I guess, we went to Germany. I just remember the guy from Digital Underground was telling us about this guy Tupac, that he, who was his dancer, and, you know, like, he was saying, "Oh yeah, Tupac, like, man, it's so hard touring with him because he gets into trouble like every city we go to." And
oh wow.
But it was before he was really rapping. It was before any of that, you know, before even I Get Around or any of that came out. But yeah, I mean, the guys from Digital Underground basically were the reason that we got picked up by a label in the first place.
And then that label, so it was called Hollywood Basic, right? And it was actually owned by the Disney company overall, right?
Yeah, it was Disney.
And it seems as though they maybe just didn't know what to do with you,
I don't think they did. I think they just, I felt like they signed us for our image, because, like, at that point people were saying I looked like the guy in 90210, and then Charisma looked like the Fresh Prince, and like, "Oh, these guys are like happy-go-lucky fun, like, it's fun rap." But we took our music really seriously as well. It wasn't like supposed to be novelty or anything like that. And then they started talking about like bringing outside producers in and stuff. And because the music I made was too like underground or too, you know. And I think, yeah, so that always stuck with me as far as like when I started my own label, like I don't want to be that guy. I think with my label, I'm like that guy the opposite way. Like when someone's making stuff that's too commercial, I'm like, no, reel it back in, like the other direction.
Put some more dirt on it, please. So the next thing that happens is that everything flips upside down, I guess. Charisma dies. Charisma died in 1993. Where were you up to when he was shot? Because I guess you were imagining that you would keep working on music, but maybe have a different plan for beyond that label or something.
Yeah, so actually that label, the head of the label had cancer, the head of that division of the hip-hop division. His name was Funkin' Klein. And he got cancer, and he never really told any of us, but we saw that he, you know, went from being healthy to having a cane to being in a wheelchair, and he always kept, like, that secret. And then that label ended up folding, and they let go of all the artists. And when we were one of the artists that were let go of, and they gave us money when they, you know, to sign a release so we wouldn't sue them or whatever. And Charisma, yeah, just, he was robbed and he kind of resisted, and that was it for him. But we were supposed to be in the studio that day, and I remember he called and left a message on my pager that he wasn't going to make it and stuff, like, oh, something came up, I'll see you tomorrow instead or something. But at the time when we were signed to the label, it felt almost like we were trying to make music for them, like rather than making music for ourselves, we were trying to guess what they would like and what would, you know, the people would like. After we got released from that label, we started making music just for ourselves again. And I think some of my favorite stuff was the stuff that was done after we got dropped from that label, like this song called I Got Methods, which was, I mean, on Spotify that has the most, you know, the most streams out of any song. So it ended up being like, you know, the closest thing to a hit, I guess.
It's interesting to think of it having an afterlife to the extent that it has like a ton of hits on Spotify.
I know,
which is
exactly
so much different to the scenario that you were in. I mean, I'm sure you must have been just knocked over by this tragedy for a long while, but you do end up making music again and resolving to continue and start a label. Tell me a little bit about how you found that resolve to continue, even though you'd lost a creative partner.
Well, that was the irony, is before I worked with them or before even seeing myself as a recording artist, I wanted to do a label and put out records. When I met him, I was like, oh, I don't want to be on the business side. I'm just going to be strictly creative. And then when he was taken, I mean, for a while I didn't know what I was going to do. And it took probably like a good year. And then eventually, I went back to my original plan of the record label.
When you set up Stone's Throw, that was 1996. And I guess around that time you were doing this marketing degree, right? You decided to study.
Well, the degree, I got the degree in 92 before Charisma passed
away. Oh, wow.
And actually, yeah, we were already signed to the major label and I was going to quit school. And my mom was like, no, over my dead body. And you know.
So did you graduate?
I did, but yeah, I only had one like semester to go when we signed with the label, and you know, you get a big chunk of change thrown at you and you just feel like you almost don't want to get your degree because then you won't try as hard to do what you really want to do, which is be a recording artist.
Did you learn anything useful?
I think what I learned more was just kind of like, it wasn't like specifics. It was just, just things kind of more in the back of my mind. Like in a way I probably learned what I was supposed to do, but I ended up not doing it anyways.
That sounds about right. So your first album is Peanut Butter Breaks. And I guess this is music that you'd been working on for some time rather than music that you'd kind of come up with more recently. Was it like that? Was it kind of newer music to that period, or was it a kind of collection of stuff that you'd had for a while? Was it stuff that you'd planned to release on with Charisma?
I think there was one song that I called Charisma on there that was supposed to be a track for him, and then we never recorded it. But I did that record. Charisma died in 93 and that record came out. Peanut Butter Breaks came out in 94 for another label. Okay. And they were putting out like instrumental hip hop records and stuff. And I never really was interested in that so much. I was like always wanted to make songs with rappers, but I figured, well, this is an opportunity for me. You know, these guys are, yeah, they're all set up and I just have to give them the tracks.
What was the immediate impact of that record? How did that kind of change what you were doing? Or was it you just filed it away and moved on and set up Stone's Throw?
No, so I put that out and it did well. At that point, like breakbeat records were doing well, like for people who wanted to sample drums and stuff.
Right.
And so every song on that Peanut Butter Breaks record has like at least one little open point where the drums are by themselves so someone can sample it. And then,
yeah, I hadn't thought of that actually. I guess there would have been a lot of DJs, even in like dance cultures at the time, who would have found the stuff like that really useful for sampling.
Yeah, and I was hearing my stuff like was just like this Incubus big hit with, like they used it, and it was just like weird like pop stuff that I didn't even think, you know, that song Garbage from that group Garbage, they used it for this track that was from the Romeo and Juliet soundtrack. And
if you
put that soundtrack on, you press play, the first thing you hear is my drums and then everything else kicks in. And I'm like, wow, this is weird. Because I just was making it for just a real niche, like hip hop underground market. But,
and one of the fans of that record was Jay Dilla, right?
Yeah, and through that record, I met Dilla. Well, I actually met House Shoes. Well, House Shoes called the number on my record, which was my pager number again.
Yeah, you could do that then. Just put your number on a record, yeah. Sure. Give me a call or a page.
Yeah, and then I called him back, and he used to always order it for the record store he was at. And then, yeah, he would always tell me about this guy, JD, and he was like, oh, yeah, JD is like a fan of the Peanut Butter Breaks, but, yeah, you got to hear his music. And, you know, it was before really he got in like nearly anywhere as far as working with people. I think it was before Q-Tip met him and stuff.
So then things start coming together in the next few years, I guess, and you kind of form a bit of a musical crew, I guess, because you have links, you've forged this link with Dilla, who's in Detroit, and then also you put out this record by Loot Pack, and that's Madlib's first project. Tell me about how did you actually find the Loot Pack crew? Where were they?
Yeah, so at that point I was living in San Francisco, and I was also working at a record distributor. Well, before I started Stone Throw, this was like in 95, I was working at the distributor and I heard Loot Pack's first 12-inch that their dad put out.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that it was Madlib's dad. So I called the number on that record and I arranged a meeting with them to sell it for my distributor. And I sold 1,000 copies, which, you know, before that they hadn't really sold any. So they were excited about that. And then I told them, hey, I have my own label. Like, I'd love to put out your stuff on my label, like put out albums. And, you know, at that point they had known about Charisma and a couple of the other records that were on my label. And they were like, yeah, cool, we're with it. So at that, yeah, that was 96, 97, I guess. I'd only had a few artists on the label, and they lived in Oxnard, which is close. It's like an hour north of LA. I guess it was about 5 hours to San Francisco from Oxnard in a car. So they would come up, and it was just so hard to ever get a hold of Madlib. But it was like basically through Wildchild. Wildchild was the main rapper in the Loot Pack. Now he's busy with his son, who's like a big actor. He's on this TV show called Blackish, which is,
oh really,
a big American show. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so his son is this kid, Miles Brown. But Wild Child was the one in the group that I was always, he was kind of the contact.
And Madlib was slippery?
Yeah, he was just awkward and shy. I didn't want to talk to anybody really. But once I got to know Madlib, like, we got really close. And again, it was like the sense of humor and stuff. But yeah, through Loot Pack, then I remember on one of the tapes, like there was this Quasimodo album that was on the back of the tape, and I asked him about that. That was really, I liked that more than the Loot Pack, you know, overall. So,
and Quasimodo is the helium voiced,
yeah.
Well, I guess then you didn't know who it was, right? You listened to it and was like, who is this voice?
Yeah, Madlib is always like, oh, I don't like my own voice. Like, he said, oh, you know, like I sound like Guru. And so he liked the sped up sound. Like, and actually it cut through in the mix a lot easier. Like, you can hear and understand what he's saying a lot easier as Quasimodo than you could as Madlib back then.
And did you have to persuade him to do more of that stuff then?
No, once we did it, once I started putting it out, he was with it. He was like, let's do it, let's do it. But it was, you know, I don't think any of us, we didn't really know who would like it or what, but, you know, we were both excited about it.
Yeah, I think that's Quasimoto is a good example of doing something that you can't really imagine if people are going to like it or not, other yeah. than you know that you do, maybe, and then it becomes like a total cult record. I mean, I remember being shown that record years ago and just being kind of amazed that it existed even. It's like, oh, this makes complete sense, but I would never have thought of this. This is right. out there on its own. But at that time, what was your vision for Stones Throw? Did you have a strong sense of what you wanted it to be like, the kind of sound or ethos of it?
I guess before meeting them, like my main roster was this group Homeless Derelicts, who I really liked, and Encore, and this guy Persevere, and I put out singles with all of them. And Automator was the guy who did Dr. Octagon, and you know, did many things after that. But Dan the Automator. Is where I would go for my mixdowns and stuff. And then I didn't have album deals with any of my artists. So then Automator signed them all to albums behind my back. And I was just like heartbroken. I couldn't believe that, number one, that he would do it. And then number two, that they would all like agree. And I never had contracts with any of my guys. I was always like, oh, I don't believe in contracts. You know, I think like, I don't want to tie anybody down who doesn't want to work with me, you know. You know, eventually like, when I did speak to an attorney, they were like, oh, well, contracts, they help the label and the artist, because otherwise, say you guys do a song and then it gets like picked up for this movie and you guys didn't like spell out who was going to get what, then you guys are just fighting over like, I think I deserve more and I deserve, no, I deserve more. So, you know, with Mad Villain, I know I'm jumping around, but with Mad Villain, like my contract with him was like, he asked for a contract, not me. And I was like, okay, so I just hand wrote like...
Who did Mad Lib?
Mad Villain, sorry. So MF Doom.
Oh, Doomist, okay.
Yeah, and so I said, okay, well, I'll hand write something. And I just wrote 50-50 deal and here's your advance. And then I signed it and then I had him sign it.
Is that legally binding? I guess it must be.
I don't know, but I showed it to my lawyer and she was like, you got to be kidding me, you know? And then she eventually had a contract that spelled everything out better for everybody. But when Mad Lib came along, it was kind of right after all those other guys had signed with Automator, and you know, I didn't have much of a roster at all, but the stuff that he was making was just, everything that he made was great to me, and it was all different genres. You know, he started doing the Yesterday's New Quintet, and
right, so he at some point he kind of completes hip-hop and decides he's going to be a jazz musician and completely pulls it off.
I mean, when he told me he was going to make jazz, I didn't believe him. And I kind of like teased him about it. But then I was like, well, okay, if you really think you're going to do this, what do you need? And he's like, I just need an electric piano. And then we went and got an electric piano at a vintage store. And then, you know, what he did just using sampling and the electric piano was just, it was like total musicianship, you know, hardly anything. And I was like, well, rather than give you an artist advance for Yesterday's New Quintet, let's just go to the vintage store and just buy a bunch of crap and like whatever you want, you know, and that'll be your advance. And we just got a bunch of synthesizers, and he knew everything from looking at the back of records and stuff. And, you know, he wanted vibes, he wanted a vibraphone, but he didn't know how to play it. And basically he figured it out like in 3 weeks. And then by the fourth week, he recorded like the whole, you know, everything for the Yesterday's New Quintet album. We put out the first one.
Makes you sick, really, doesn't it?
And where we were living, you know, we were all roommates. It was me and him and a couple other guys. And I mean, our living room was just all of his instruments. And, you know, the vibes were all set up because it's like a big instrument. And the kitchen like had the keyboards and, you know, the drums were over here. It was just, we never had people over. So it just seemed, it totally made sense to me. But one time when we did have someone over, they're like, wow, this is weird, like look at your kitchen, look at this, look at that.
So you were living with Mad Lib at this time in this house with I guess I had imagined that there was a studio in it, but it was more like the studio was the house, you just lived in it.
Yeah, so when I first moved to LA, it was right by the beach and right by the airport. So we moved there, and then we were there for a year, and then the guy I was just renting, and the guy that I was paying my rent to, he wasn't paying the mortgage, so the house got taken away from him, and then we got evicted, and then I found another place. And then the second place that I, where I moved to, is kind of the neighborhood that I'm in now. That had like what was called the bomb shelter, because the house that we were in at the time, it was like set up underground, and it was built during the Cold War, and the bomb shelter was like a selling point of that house. Like, hey, if the Cold War happens, then you guys are safe here.
When Madlib and Dilla met and started collaborating, what year would that have been?
Well, I first started talking to Dilla around 96. I put out a record with him with House Shoes. And then maybe 97 or 98, Dilla had an offshoot group called J88, which was basically Slum Village, but it was a way for them to record for another label. And yeah, that label, Groove Attack, they were like, hey, would you guys want to do a remix? Would Madlib want to do a remix for J88, for the J Dilla project? Well, he wasn't called Dilla then, JD. You know, Madlib was a big fan. He's like, oh yeah, of course. And you know, this was right when we put out the Lupac album, and mostly everybody that I talked to that we were fans of at the time, they all found out about Lupac through JD. So I had a friend of mine who became a writer, and I guess he interviewed D'Angelo back in 98, and he asked D'Angelo, what's your favorite album? And he said, oh, it's Lupac. And I found out about Lupac through JD. You know, JD's always swearing by this record and stuff. So, and you know, we were like huge fans of, mainly Slum Village, but all the stuff, I guess, that JD did for Tribe and Farside and, you know, all the other groups too. So being fans of each other, I guess, started around 98, and then Madlib doing that remix, I think, was also like 98, 99. But the first time they physically met was early 2000s, and J-Rock, he would bring his camcorder and record everything. And, you know, thankfully he was there and caught it on tape.
What was that meeting like? Because I was wondering if them collaborating would have been interesting for you, because they were also both inspired by you, by a record that you made.
I never really thought of that, but they both told me that. I don't know how true it was, but...
But it's like three people in a room who are all very deeply inspired by each other, and I kind of like the idea that there's almost a non-hierarchical meeting of people who are just really, really buzzed about what the other people are doing.
Well, the first time we met them was Slum Village, when Slum Village did a show in LA, and that was just real quick, like, hey, what's up? Hey, I'm JD. Hey, I'm Madlib. And then, you know, but I would talk to JD on the phone, I guess. The first time we were supposed to meet was on 9/11, 2001. And then
Wow. We
had a flight to Detroit to go there and work on some stuff for JD's album. And, you know, that flight obviously got canceled. And then after that, Madlib was like, nah, fuck that. I'm not getting on a plane. For months, he was like, no, I'm not going to get on a plane. And so we looked into like taking a train there, and it would have taken 5 days each way. But we were still like, you know, we were down to do that. And then I was getting ready to buy the tickets, and then Madlib's like, no, all right, fine, I'll get on a plane. Because JD was like trying to finish his album for MCA, and the concept of that album was JD rapping over everybody else's tracks. So he had like, you know, a Kanye track, and I don't really remember, but it was pretty much like, you know, a who's who of like who was making beats at the time.
So the few years after that, that period for Stone's Throw produces some albums that would be considered, I think, foundational, not only by the label standards, but for rap fans in general. J-Lib, Donuts, Mad Villain. So Doom at some point, I guess, becomes part of the circle. Although actually I felt that in the Stone's Throw documentary, I think it's quite obvious that Doom is about as slippery as you'd maybe expect him to be.
Yeah, he really was. I mean, but, you know, he lived with us for a period of time as well.
Right.
At one point, it was, myself, Madlib, Egon, who was the GM of Stone's Throw at the time, and Jeff.
This period of time, late 90s going into early noughties, was a really good time for independent hip hop, as it was, I guess, being called, underground hip hop.
Yeah.
Because hip hop had its mainstream moment, or was in its mainstream moment, and you had Eminem and Dre, Jay-Z, and then there was the kind of Southern rap thing coming through with Nelly and people like that. And then, so you had these other channels emerging, so Stone's Throw, and then on the East Coast, Raucous, and Def Jux. And I think this is, it's intriguing to me because hip hop had obviously started out being so, alternative, and then things change, and the alternative becomes the mainstream, and the mainstream produces its own alternative. How much was any of that on your mind at the time? Was it important to you to kind of stake out an alternative to what was happening in rap at the time?
I think by the mid 2000s, we weren't really even, I mean, I myself, I wasn't really following what other people were doing as much. It was so hard for me to keep up with everything Madlib was doing. I didn't have time to listen to anything else. And I didn't really want to hear anything else, I guess. But, you know, when I started Stone's Throw in 96, there was like a lot of, well, you mentioned Raucous, but like Fond Alum, and there were a lot of other like indie things that sounded kind of like Wu-Tang or like Mobb Deep, you know, like that whole sound, or DITC. And I mean, even looking back, I don't know much of like the mid 2000 indie stuff, I guess, or commercial stuff.
Were you getting any coverage in the kind of mainstream hip hop magazines or anything? Like, would your records have been in Vibe or The Source, places like that?
Never.
Okay, so it was that level of underground.
Yeah, and when we like, so The Source, they wrote up Lupac, for example, and they gave us, I think, 2.5 mics or 3.5 or something. It was like something that upset us at the time. We never got coverage. We could never get an interview or anything like that for any of the Madlib stuff. And you know, I remember at that point I was trying to get Madlib work outside of our crew. Like, you know, just like JD was doing so much stuff. And as I hit up Wendy Goldstein, who was, I think, maybe the head of Motown or something, and I sent her Madlib's beats, and I was like, this guy's, you know, got it. And I mean, just not to single anybody out, but like pretty much everywhere I sent it, no one was really interested. But Madlib would always get, he had a lot of interest on the underground from like people. I mean, if you go to Discogs and you look at his remixes that he was doing back then, it was a lot of artists that he didn't like at all, but he just needed to make rent, or, you know, he needed money, and he was just doing it just on the side and stuff. And I remember one day I was like, I want to do a box set of all your stuff. And then he's like, okay, but only if we can do a second box set of all the whack shit that I had to do, like, just to make ends meet. But some of it, yeah, we would just make fun of it so hard, you know.
In the documentary, I hate to keep referring back to the documentary, but there are a lot of good jumping off points in the documentary.
Yeah.
But also a lot of things that aren't covered. In the documentary, there are a few mentions of the word counterculture. And I feel like that's maybe instructive or meaningful in a different way for someone who's from the Bay Area as well. And I was curious about what you thought of the countercultural inspirations for the label, whether there was that kind of Californian's influence of counterculture,
right?
That kind of lineage,
like,
in what you were doing at all, right? But then I guess it's quite a complicated lineage, isn't it? Because it's beats and it's hippies and then it's Silicon Valley and what is it now? And I just wondered if that was
the weed culture too.
The what? Sorry,
the weed culture in California.
Yeah,
like the weed in California was just like a lot stronger. Right. I never really was a big weed smoker, but like most of the artists that I work with are, you know.
Yeah, I think living in that house, it wouldn't have mattered.
Yeah. It was a lot of secondhand smoke going around. But like, I never like realized, because people would say, oh, you guys have like a California sound of hip hop or a West Coast sound. And
right.
There are those influences that we never even really thought about, you know. It was like, it was our bastardization of New York rap, but us not being from New York is going to make it different. And also, like, New York was like headphone culture. Like, nobody has a car in New York. Everyone takes the train, you know. And so they just listen to stuff on a Walkman with the headphones. And then in the West Coast, everybody has a car. And almost as important, or maybe more important than what kind of car you have, is like how good your sound system is in your car. And so, I mean, from the 90s until recently, there's always like a subwoofer in the trunk. And I remember one of my friends from the East Coast, when he came to LA and he was in my car, he's like, I can't believe you have a subwoofer. That's so funny, man. It's something that you don't even really think about. It's just part of the culture. But what I mean by that is like a lot of the West Coast stuff, like the Dre sound and the G-Funk, you have the crisp highs and the piercing lows. And and then New York, it's more about like finding the roughest like drum sounds. And I mean, this is how it was back then, at least, you know.
What about the influence of non-hip hop? Because I know that you're into loads of other types of music as well. And I wondered if maybe there was actually a, as well as any kind of Californian counterculture, there's just like a punk thing going on, a new wave thing.
Well, also, I mean, the records that we were sampling from, it was a lot easier for us to find records from the West Coast than maybe, you know, our New York counterparts. So we were sampling from psychedelic rock records a little bit more. And, you know, the jazz records, I mean, that was kind of like everybody was into that in the 90s. But we had jazz records that it was easier for us to find on the West Coast that you might not find in the East Coast.
And punk, though? Was that like
I mean, I love punk personally. And like, that's why when the Beastie Boys first came out. So me in high school, I dressed kind of punk. And I buy my clothes from thrift stores and dress like the Brady Bunch and stuff. In the 80s, when like, you know, you're not supposed to dress like the 70s and the 80s or the 60s. Most of the people that listened to hip hop, they wore like sweats and, you know, starter jackets and baseball caps and stuff. And at that time, I was dressed like a British new waver or something, but then I listened to hip hop. And so I was not really accepted by either culture, I guess. Like, you have to kind of be one thing and stick to it. But when the Beastie Boys did it, and they kind of made it acceptable, like they were, you know, wearing thrift store clothes and acting punk, but then they were making hip hop music. And it was kind of like silly hip hop, but then it still got like acceptance, like from the most hardcore, you know, like whether it's Ice Cube and NWA or whoever, they all like sampled the Beastie Boys.
Moving into the kind of final stretch, kind of, I have these slightly dorky quick fire questions. Okay, bear with me. If Stone's Throw was an animal, what animal would it be? Oh God. Okay, well, you'll have to do an audio description.
This is the Stone's Throw mascot, Orbit.
Whoa.
She's 11 years old. She just...
Why is she called Orbit?
Oh, my wife named her Orbit, like, before I came in the picture many years ago, but...
And what kind of dog was it, sorry?
It's a Shih Tzu, Imperial Shih Tzu or Teacup.
Okay. If Stone's Throw was a menu item, what would it be?
It would be raw like sushi. I don't know.
If Stone's Throw was a season... Not a seasoning.
I know.
Just a
I was thinking seasoning because we were talking about food. Probably springtime. But I don't know why. But a lot of our music these days is kind of yacht rocky springtime happy vibes.
Would you rather be up early or out late?
That's changed through the years. I think I've been getting up early. Well, I kind of do both, I guess. I get up early and I'm out late.
Would you rather be in the desert or in the mountains?
Definitely the desert.
Well, that's the only Californian answer, really, I guess. Well, no, you do have mountains too.
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to my wife about it, and we don't really care to like be out there with the bears and the, well, I was gonna say snakes, but snakes are in the desert, so. But we actually, yeah, we took Orbit to the desert one time, and it was daytime, it was fine, and then once the sun went down, we were like out kind of in the middle of nowhere, and then we hear this and it was a rattlesnake, and we couldn't even like see where it was coming from. We're like, all right, we need to go to the car right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure I fancy Orbit's chances against a rattlesnake either, to be honest. No,
and she will go straight for it.
Would you rather be in the city or the country?
Well, this has to do with me getting older. I think before it was all about the city. And, you know, even, I mean, as soon as I was old enough to move out of San Jose, I moved to San Francisco, and that has a real city vibe. And LA, I mean, even though LA's the second biggest city in the US, but it's still, well, I was going to say it doesn't have as much, it definitely doesn't have as much of a city vibe as San Francisco does. I mean, there's no public transport in LA really that's being used, at least. That doesn't really answer the question.
Fine. What was the last film you saw?
My wife's always watching films, and I'm like, kind of watching it, but not knowing what it is. We just watched this Adam Sandler stupid movie last night. It was just a brainless one, because I really have a hard time like paying attention with films. So
really,
yeah,
music or nothing.
If it's too much of a plot, then I can't pay attention. So I usually I'm on my computer on Discogs while she watches a movie.
Yeah, right. In which case, what was the last record you bought? Maybe while you were watching the film.
I know. There's so many. Yeah, I buy like...
Do you buy so many records that you wouldn't be able to say what was the last record that you bought?
Definitely not. Yeah, no, I can't answer that one.
Wow. Okay. Stone's Throw has always been committed to releasing vinyl. It seems like that's something you're still committed to doing. And there's a lot. I was looking through Discogs and checking what you had. And there are many more kind of one-off but there are many more 12s and kind of bits than I was expecting. There are a lot of individual individual records. And in recent years we've seen this vinyl revival of sorts. People are kind of into buying vinyl again. They enjoy having it as an object. I think people enjoy the ceremony of actually putting a record on and so on. But it definitely feels as though hip hop and vinyl are not integrated anymore. And I wondered if you're interested at all, kind of concerned as a kid who bought a record in order to, who bought a turntable in order to sound like you were scratching.
Yeah.
Are you concerned that this, you know, one of the four elements, the vinyl skills are going to kind of fade out from hip hop?
I never really worry too much about that. I mean, the new rap stuff is so, yeah, it's definitely far removed from the New York kind of like Bronx, like origins of hip hop. I don't even have anything witty to say about it, I guess, at this point, but... It's just there are young people who, I mean, I just even see on my Instagram DMs like a lot of kids in high school that are, they're digging deeper and like trying to learn about other music as well. And it's not like the norm, but there are people out there who are doing it. So,
right. Yeah. It's just part of being interested in the alternative seam of a culture, I guess.
I think, I mean, Tyler, the Creator, you know, like when he was 15, he was really like into like the older hip hop and then even just the stuff that was coming out before hip hop. So
I think Tyler, the Creator, is someone who, and Old Future in general, is someone who makes sense within a trajectory that includes Stone's Throw, you know? Like,
yeah.
I think what Old Future are doing is maybe part of, well, maybe do you feel like you can sense the influence of Stone's Throw on the West Coast trajectory? I know that you used to have Philo was an intern, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's the Madlib and Dilla, but someone like Tyler, it seemed like he was more, he found out about Stone's Throw from artists like Jaunty and the Step Kids and, you know, stuff.
Yeah, that, so not the hip hop.
Not even the hip hop. And then, I don't know how much of the hip-hop he knows.
I wanted to talk about a few of the quote-unquote weirder records, although, you know, many of them are weird in their own weird ways. Someone who I think got kind of raw deal in the documentary was Gary Wilson, who is, you know, kind of a legend, a strange legend, but a legend nonetheless. And I think he kind of appears as this like kind of guy in a fright wig and some trash bags. And he's like serenading a doll. And there isn't really an explanation about why he's the whole thing.
Well, I think I got the raw deal in that part of the movie too, because it was like, okay, we were doing all this great hip hop. And then one day Wolf just lost his mind and then put out Gary Wilson, you know.
But tell me, how did you originate? Did you already know who Gary Wilson was? How did you find him? Because he was like a kind of 70s punk, real eccentric, was doing these very elaborate kind of offensive live performances, I guess. And then he disappeared, right?
Yeah, I found out about him through my friend Dwayne, who worked at this record store called Other Music. They just actually released a documentary on that movie. Maybe that was the last movie I saw.
Well, you would have paid attention to that one. Because it's like looking at Discogs.
Yeah, I found out about Gary through them. And I had a gig in New York. And after my gig, I asked the promoter, I was like, so where's my hotel? And they're like, oh, you're just going to stay over this guy, this guy Dwayne's house. You're just gonna stay at his house. And I was like, what? Like, I was like, all right, whatever. And then I stayed at it. And then we walked to his house. He lived in the Bronx. And you know, I didn't know my way around New York. I'm like, is this all cool or what's going on here? I went to sleep, and then in the morning I just heard this crazy music. It was really weird, and I asked him what it was, and he's like, oh, this is Gary Wilson. And I just loved it, and you know, I asked him to make me a tape of it. It was too hard to get the vinyl. And then eventually there was a store in Philly that came up on a bunch of old copies of it. It was record You Think You Really Know Me from 1977. So I bought like as many copies as I can get, because they were only like, I think, $10 each or something, like through a mail order. This was in the early 2000s, and I just gave them to everybody I knew. And I just kind of preached it like it was gospel. And I remember I turned Dilla on to Gary Wilson and Common. And so every time I saw Common, because Common used to live with Dilla, and Common would be like, hey, what's up with Gary Wilson, man? You know, at anything. That was like our little like thing. Yeah, I turned Dilla on to Gary Wilson, who he loved. And then Dilla turned me on to Bruce Hack, who is like equally like one of my favorites.
Yeah, that's like a kind of early electronic stuff, right?
It is, yeah. But it was kind of, I mean, he made electronic stuff and he also made psychedelic rock stuff.
But so you found Gary and asked him to make some more music, I guess. How did that happen?
So back to Gary, I wanted to put out the old record, and I started calling Gary Wilson's like into the phone book. He just like, it wasn't really, it was before internet was like.
How many Gary Wilsons are there in the phone book?
Well, that's the problem. He didn't have the right name to do it that way. And so obviously I didn't come up with anything. And then this other label, they hired a private investigator, and they found him, and they put out the old record. And then there was a documentary that was being worked on him, and they asked me to... No, I wasn't even involved in the documentary. What happened was a magazine knew that I was a fan of Gary Wilson, so they asked me to interview him.
Oh.
Kind of like Interview Magazine, where an artist interviews an artist or whatever. And
yeah, yeah.
I did that interview, and then at the end of the interview, I was like, hey, here's my new record, by the way. You know, he gave me like a CD like that he burned of some new music. And I was like really afraid to listen to it. I thought for sure I wasn't going to like it.
Right.
But I loved it. I really liked it. And I put out his... you know, contemporary music.
What was he like?
Well, that was the other thing is when I was trying to put out the old album, when I spoke to the guy at the distributor who, that was a lead to me, you know, because he was like that distributor that was selling his old records. They're like, oh no, you don't want to work with him. He's a nightmare to deal with. He's terrible. Mm-hmm. And so I'm all thinking, oh, this guy's probably got anger issues and blah, blah, blah. But when I met him, he was like so easy to deal with. And to this day, I mean, you know, I've known him probably 15, 20 years now, and he's always been like a joy. He's like so easy.
Oh,
so sweet.
That's really nice.
I mean, I love hanging out with him. Like when he comes to LA, we'll go grab a burger or whatever.
And he must have really interesting taste in music himself, right? Because he has this kind of like lounge jazz background, but also as a punk. Yeah.
Right. And I mean, because his early stuff, he was playing upright bass, and it's like, yeah, it's more jazz. And then he went.
Yeah, there's not many people playing upright bass in the scene in general.
Exactly.
I think that Gary Wilson definitely underlines Stone's Throw as a kind of a place that welcomes eccentrics to a certain extent. And there are all kinds of other records on the label that feel like that to some extent. Maybe Baron Zen, who is your childhood friend, Steve, which is like a kind of lo-fi, garagey kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's pop music, but it's homemade.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess you could say that Gary Wilson isn't so far off Falerio.
Yeah, Falerio.
In a sense, a kind of flamboyant alter ego. Falerio is you, obviously. Well, not obviously. I mean, rumor has it.
Right.
What does it take for Falerio to appear? Why was that suddenly a kind of avenue for expression?
I don't know. I'm trying to think if Dilla ever met Falerio. No, Falerio was after he passed, I think. But Dilla would have loved Falerio. It's weird to talk about Falerio. Let's talk about Gary.
Pretend he's not here.
No, because Falerio and I, we always get in these arguments where we're not talking and for a long time and stuff. So Falerio is just really, he's Falerio is difficult. Yeah, he's the opposite of Gary Wilson.
Oh, right. Okay.
in that sense. But Gary, I mean, Gary and Flerio get along well, but me and Flerio never do.
Was it about something about needing to make music that was unrelated to things that you'd done before, like a different kind of creative itch in some sense?
Well, the Flerio was basically, those songs were demos that I discovered when I was working at a record distributor. There was this website called mp3.com where anybody can just load up their songs. It was basically like a SoundCloud, you know, before SoundCloud. And someone who was working there, he took all the worst demos that had ever been uploaded on mp3.com, and he made a compilation, and it kind of circulated around the music industry. And I had a copy of that in the 90s, and I would play it for my friends, you know, in the 2000s. And then for two of those songs, like I, as a DJ, like in the 2000s, I started doing video sets, like DJing, VJing, you know, where I'm playing a music video behind me. And there's some songs that I always wanted to have a video for. So I asked my friend Valerio, my friend at the time, if he would sit in and pretend like he was the one singing those songs. So he's actually not the singer on it. He's like lip syncing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the songs aren't even really Valerio. They're like somebody else, but
I like it. That's a good story. I think that's it's like worthy of like a kind of James Ferraro or like a weird like vaporwave project or one of those kind of.
Yeah, it was kind of like that
internet
whole irony.
Things.
Yeah. And I know there was like a website called look at this fucking hipster.com, and they posted the Flerio video and they just talked all this crap about him. Like, look at, who's this guy you think he is? You know, and they were really like angry with Flerio.
Another great eccentric on the label in his own different way is Dame Funk. Mm-hmm. And when you signed Dame Funk, I get the impression he was maybe already a little bit older, like not the youngest guy, and he had like a normal job.
Right.
And he was making his like weird, extremely funky music at home. And then you decided to kind of introduce him to the world. Or maybe it was actually his second record that was like a box set, a 5LP box set. Was it the first or the second?
Yeah, that was the first thing we put out.
So, that was the first.
Yeah, I mean, I would DJ like kind of 80s funk music a lot and, you know, the aughts, I guess. Dame came to one of my gigs and he's like, hey, I love what you're playing tonight. Like, I DJ as well and I play this stuff too. And, and then I went to one of, he invited me to one of his gigs. I think we were like keeping up with each other through MySpace and stuff. And then again, kind of like Gary Wilson, he like gave me a CD of his music one day and I wasn't really sure, you know, if I would like it or whatever. And I was with Koshik at the time, who's like one of my favorite artists on the label that, you know, never really achieved like much success or notoriety. But Koshik and I, we were listening to Dame's stuff in the car and, you know, we both really liked it. So I just hit Dame up and asked him about doing a record. And I think he just had so much music like that he had been doing for years and years, you know, and never really released any of it with the label, that we just thought a box set might be the best way to go with it.
Were there any fraught internal discussions about whether this was a sensible economic decision?
No, we didn't even think about it. No, we just did it.
I think it's a cool example, again, of not really knowing if people are going to be into it. But then Snoop Dogg does a record with him. And actually, that all works out great, you know?
Yeah.
Of course. The perfect collaborator, really.
I mean, the Snoop Dogg record, I thought, turned out great. But it didn't really do that well for us, considering, you know, what we thought it would do. I mean, Snoop had just put out the Snoop Lion and, you know, it had...
Oh, yeah. The reggae record.
People were upset about that or whatever. But I thought the record we did was great. Or the record they did without me. I mean, they basically, did, the two of them did it and, you know, they turned it in as is and we didn't need to send them back to the drawing board or anything.
It occurred to me with the Dame Funk box set, though, that it's the kind of, it's almost like a practical joke. It's almost like a prank. It's so absurd. And From what I gathered of Charisma on the documentary, it kind of struck me as something that he would have like really approved of in some way.
What, doing
like,
the just, box set? Or?
Yeah, just says like, fuck it, let's do something that's like kind of ridiculous, because there's hints of you guys maybe being pranksters essentially.
Right, yeah. I mean, Dame at that point, he didn't have a lot of fans, but his fans that he had were so hardcore that they would buy a box set, I felt. You
oh,
know?
Wow. So. Yeah, okay. Couple more things. I wanted to bring us right up to date with a Stone's Throw record that is probably my favorite Stone's Throw of the last couple of years, and it's only just come out, which is the John Carroll Kirby record. It's called My Garden.
Heard the sequencing on that one's really good.
The sequencing, yeah, definitely. Very, very carefully ordered by someone. So I already knew a little bit about him when I pressed play, but I think if I hadn't known about him, I would have been quite struck by this like unique sound, because I know it from the Solange albums that he's contributed towards. And it's such a beautiful sound, because it's like, it's very organic in a sense and jazzy and musical, but it's also very much his own signature. And I guess that's why he's kind of ended up with you. But tell me a bit about John Carroll Kirby as a kind of potentially a signifier of what Stone's Throw are about.
I mean, I didn't even think he would sign with us because of the stuff with Solange and everything. I felt like he was already like at that level where, you know, majors would be really interested in, or he's been super easy to work with, and he's like a real team player too. I noticed, like, I mean, you know, like if I'm looking on people's Instagrams, like on some of the other artists' Instagrams, I notice he makes comments on their Instagram, or, you know, hits that like button or whatever. Like, it just feels like he's a team player.
Do you envisage him potentially working with other Stone's Throw artists, maybe?
I was thinking about that, because we're in the middle of finishing this album with this artist, Steve Arrington, the singer that I've been a fan of since I was a kid. And Steve's new album has, production from pretty much like all the artists that I'm working with currently. John Carroll Kirby would be, a great person for that.
The overarching trend in the music business of recent years is this real consolidation of power in not major labels so much as tech companies. Apple, Google, Spotify have so much power now, and major labels are kind of entwined in that in certain ways. What do you think will be the role of an independent label in the future?
I feel like it's always been promotion and money, and I feel like it still could be that in the future. You know, we have the ability to reach a lot more people than somebody who has zero Instagram followers and zero, you know, has never put anything out or hasn't been able to get a show or anything like that as far as a live show. I mean, yeah, we just have a lot of resources at our fingertips that people starting out don't necessarily have it. And some people just want to work with us because of the records that we've put out in the past, you know, and just be part of that legacy, I guess.
And I guess finally, what have you got coming up in the next few months that you're most excited to share with the world?
Well, one album is with an artist that's a little more known that hasn't signed the contract yet, but he's turned in the album, so I'm excited about that one.
Is that an artist that cannot be named?
Just because of the, But yeah, Steve Arrington, I really like how his albums turned out. There's a lot of new artists. We signed an artist, Maylee Todd. We haven't announced her signing yet, but she's from Canada and really talented, does everything on her own. Sophie's another one, you know, her album's coming out soon.
And if you were 20 years old again, or maybe even younger, however old you were when you wrote your high school essay, do you think you would run a record label again if you're 20 years old again?
I think so. I don't know what else I would do that I would enjoy. I still love my job. I still feel like I'm working with artists who are making a difference. Yeah, just fulfilling a need in music that I personally like, at least.
Peanut Butter Wolf, thank you very much.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Relevant Parties from Carhartt Work in Progress. If you want to dive into more music from the labels in this series, check out the Relevant Parties playlist on Spotify. You can find the link in the show notes. And remember, you can subscribe to Relevant Parties so that you never miss an episode. It's available wherever good podcasts are found. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave a rating and a comment on Apple Podcasts. We'd really love to know what you think. So thanks for listening, and join me next time for more stories behind the world's best record labels.